If bird strikes can bring down an airliner, what's being done about the problem? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. In the wake of the Flight 1549 water landing on the Hudson River in New York City, a lot of attention has been drawn to the issue of bird strikes in aviation. I think a lot of people who are involved in aviation are aware of bird strikes, maybe had not been aware of how often they occur or how underreported they are. And in doing a little looking into the various efforts around the country to deal with this problem, I came upon the effort at SeaTac Airport in the Northwest. And this airport appears to be well along in this. Maybe more work has been done there on this topic than anywhere else that I have read about in the country. And we wanted to talk to somebody who was directly involved with that program. My guest today is Port of Seattle biologist Steve Osmick. Steve, thanks for taking some time out for our listeners today.
Oh, certainly. Glad to be here.
Now, first of all, let me ask you about the Seattle area. This would seem to be kind of a perfect storm for bird issues, because not only are you near water, but I think there are some Pacific migratory routes that probably pass directly through your area. What were the unique challenges that made Seattle the first area to have a dedicated wildlife biologist on staff?
Yeah, one of the first things that happened at SeaTac Airport is once starlings made it across North America, and that was probably in the 50s, and starling populations then took hold and kept building, it really became a problem by the time we hit the mid-70s. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had estimated that there were perhaps as many as 80 to 100,000 starlings in flocks that were moving around the airport. So, you know, as you can imagine, that was quite an aviation hazard at that point. The difference then versus now is there weren't as many aircraft movements, so it was a little bit easier to control. And that's why Dennis Bowman came out from the seaport area to work really full-time on managing the starling issues.
Now, the starlings, I think this is interesting in a couple of ways. The starlings are a non-native species, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. In the late 1800s, there were folks who released, I'm told, about 40 starlings in Central Park, because the idea was to release birds that Shakespeare spoke about in his plays. And it's just phenomenal, I think, as far as a species that adapted so quickly that it moved from the extreme East Coast all the way over to Washington by about the 1950s.
Well, and it's kind of, I don't know, I have to, the phrase that comes to mind is, what were they thinking? Because Shakespeare notwithstanding, starlings aren't known as a particularly enjoyable bird to have in your yard.
Yeah, it must have been their call or their song that they were missing. It's hard to know. But in the industry today, in the airport industry, they're referred to as a feathered bullet. And you may have heard that before.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason for that is because their wings are actually quite small compared to their dense body mass. So when an aircraft moving at high speeds do hit starlings, they usually pack a pretty good wallop. And because they do fly in such dense flocks that if there are ingestions, frequently, you know, many birds get ingested into an engine or at least hit the leading edges of the aircraft.
Now, this had to be really untried ground back in the 70s when Dennis came on board, because when I think of the Northwest, I lived in Portland for 10 years. And one of the things I found amusing when I first got there was a debate raging at the time about the endangered terns were eating the endangered salmon. People wringing their hands saying, what do we do now? Anytime you get into an environmentally sensitive issue in your part of the country, it becomes kind of controversial. Was this as big a part of the job for Dennis when he came on, maybe, and maybe for you continuing today, as actually figuring out what to do?
You know, I'm not sure if it really was. I mean, a couple of things. I mean, that was in the 70s, you know, and even 30 years ago, I think attitudes were a little bit different. But secondarily, you're looking at a bird species that we know, since they've moved into North America, that they have been doing quite a bit of damage as far as out-competing nesting habitat for songbirds. So they're not really a bird that's loved even by the various, you know, birding societies out there. So it really hasn't been an issue. And over the years, the problem has been controlled by using our starling live traps, which have been really effective at capturing just starlings, and of course, any other bird that we would capture, since they are live traps, they can just be released.
Now, when you say a live trap, what do you do with live starlings after you trap them?
Well, we do humanely euthanize them, and we're using CO2 gas to do that, which is, you know, something that is actually a recommended euthanasia technique by the avian veterinary medicine group. And so, you know, from my standpoint, I mean, I got into wildlife because I really like wildlife, and anytime we start dealing with things like that, when we're euthanizing large numbers, especially when we could be taking 3,000 in a given year, we're giving most of those over to the Burke Museum and to some other establishments, even the Smithsonian from time to time. They have students that can use these birds for various studies or preparing study skins. So that's one of the things we do, is that if we do take birds, if we do lethal removal, then we do try to make those available to other institutions.
Okay, now what is the history of bird strikes at SeaTac? Is it a bigger problem than in many areas of the country? Is it just due to traffic?
Well, you know, you really have to go back probably to the 70s when it started, and I was going through some of Dennis's old records, and it looked like we had 4 strikes a year in the late 70s. And a lot of things have changed between then and now, which this last year, 2008, we recorded 105 strikes. As I mentioned before, of course, the number of movements have increased dramatically, aircraft movements. But the other thing is that the FAA really began a formal FAA, you know, wildlife strike database in 1990. So since that time, the word has gotten out that the FAA, and for that matter, I make it clear to the airlines here that I'm also interested in getting these strike reports. And so by me getting out there, beating the turf, if you want to call it that, I'm able to get my strike reports up higher and higher. It's not to say, of course, that we're getting more strikes. What we're doing is we're getting a better idea of how many strikes actually are occurring out there.
Well, I've heard it said that only 1 in 10 strikes is reported nationwide. Does that match with your experience?
Well, yeah, I've heard a range might be 1 in 5, but yet I think here at SeaTac, since we do annual presentations to the airline maintenance groups, and we do really try to get the word out that we're interested in collecting the snarge, which is the, I guess, the Smithsonian term for snot and garbage, which really is the remains of birds on the aircraft,
yeah.
That once we start getting that material and we get it sent in, and I can go back to the airlines and say, thank you, we found out that this was a killdeer, and we've had killdeer that have cost $57,000 worth of damage. Then they begin to realize that we're here really to help them. We're trying to keep the cost down to an absolute minimum. We're trying to find out the types of birds that are causing the problem, so we can go out there, manipulate habitat, and make sure that we don't have these birds hanging out close to the runway.
Well, Steve, we need to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about some of the larger birds that planes encounter in your area. My guest is Steve Osmick, wildlife biologist at the Port of Seattle. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR22 GTS, Cirrus's premium luxury ride that has come to define Cirrus aircraft as one of the world's elite. Every dream option, from supple leather seats to an exhilarating 310 horsepower performance and speed, come standard, giving new meaning to the phrase fully loaded. When flying the SR22 GTS, getting there is truly more than half the fun. To learn more, call 888-750-9000 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design. Clarity Aloft headsets employ patented Comply Canal tips, composed of soft viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. More than simple earplugs, these foam tips provide full-spectrum noise reduction and outstanding attenuation. This advanced technology is lab-tested, proving that viscoelastic passive noise reduction is superior to active noise reduction. For more information, information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. I'm Paul Platt, talking about bird strikes with Port of Seattle wildlife biologist Steve Osmick. Steve, we talked about starlings in particular and touched on a couple of other species. You also have waterfowl in your area, too, and you have predatory birds. How is that mix?
Well, when you look at bird species or clades or groups of birds, really the management technique is about as different as they are. An example of that would be the ducks, which ironically, even though we're fairly close to Puget Sound, we're about 2 miles away, waterfowl isn't a species that ranks highest. It's probably gulls, and then we get some gulls, raptors, and then we get starlings and some of the smaller birds. The interesting thing about SeaTac Airport is that we're essentially a shaved off hilltop. And as a result, a lot of the wetland areas and the habitat that would produce, you know, large flocks of waterfowl tends to be below the surface of the runway. And what that means is that these birds are flying around the airport. And so not as many fly over the runways and cross those movement areas.
Okay, well, tell us about some of the means you use other than these live traps. What is used both at SeaTac and in your experience at other airports to try to mitigate this problem? And is it ever permanent? I mean, if you scare them away, do they come back?
Well, let's just start off with that one because that's a very good question. And really what you're asking about is the pyrotechnics. They're noisemakers, and we use about 5 or 6 different kinds. And the reason we use that variety is because you really do need to mix and match the pyrotechnics. They make different sounds, especially if you use them in combination with one another, and you get a different scare response from them. But what happens is if you overuse a pyrotechnic, then yes, and I think this is what you're getting at, they can get used to that pyrotechnic, and that's where lethal removal comes in. And it is necessary from time to time to use lethal removal, not to go and depopulate an area, but it's essentially just to reinstate, if you will, that fear response, that fright-flight response. So a good example of that was this last summer where we had some Canada geese on the airport, and there was a lot of pyrotechnics that were used. When I went out there and launched a pyrotechnic, all 8 of the geese didn't move. They stood there and they looked at me. And that was an example of where I went out and I had to remove 2, and the other 6, believe it or not, just stood there. So all those animals were removed, and we really got the word out that, you know, we do need to use a combination of the lethal, which of course some of our folks here don't like doing as much, and also the pyrotechnics. And I think by doing so, you can really reduce the long-term lethal removal that's required because you keep those birds afraid of those noises that are being produced by the pyrotechnics.
How effective are dogs? Have you guys looked at doing that in Seattle?
Yeah, we have. And I've actually used dogs around the airport on the outside of the AOA fence line. And with some of our real thick scrub shrub habitat, dogs really couldn't work it that well. We had geese in the ponds. They're fairly slow swimmers compared to a goose. And so the dogs weren't as effective as I think they could be in some agricultural areas where they have large fields and good populations of geese. In contrast, what worked well, though, is we put out a remote-controlled boat. And we just chased the geese down with the boat, and we got the waterfowl to leave that way.
That's interesting. Now, when you do get something that scares birds away from that area, that habitat is still left behind, and I mean, others would come, maybe the ones you've scared away would calm down and come back. Do they actually learn these things? And you mentioned that you had to use lethal removal to reinforce the pyrotechnics. Do birds actually learn from watching what happens to other birds that they shouldn't be there?
Oh, they certainly do. And what's kind of interesting, and I hate to get into a situation of whether I think a bird is smarter than another, but there really are differences.
Uh-huh.
If you look at crows, you know, the standard American crow that we see around. Of all the crows we have here at the airport, and believe me, we still do harass them, but we've only had two that were struck in probably, you know, that's since about 1977. So we're looking at about 30 years worth of data. On the flip side, you get gulls, and there's quite a few gulls around too, but we consistently get 3, 4, 5, up to 8 gulls a year that are struck. There is a difference between birds and how well they learn and how well they not only respond to pyrotechnics, but also how aware they are of dangers, whether it's planes or perhaps other things in the environment.
If a jet is coming in to land at SeaTac or taking off from SeaTac, is it just a matter of intelligence? Do birds really even have a chance, or are the planes just moving too fast for the birds to even be aware of them until it's too late?
Well, I think they really do realize it, but again, I think it's more related to the bird. I've seen crows many times, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock at night, north end of the airport, you'll get a flock of crows that's going from the west to east, flying east to the roost, and you'll have an aircraft that comes in, and sure enough, the crows will stop, they make a big circle, wait for that aircraft to pass, and then they keep flying. So there really is something to that. On the flip side, you get gulls or something, and they would just keep flying. Or a great blue heron, you could harass them with pyrotechnics, and you may divert their flight a little bit, just change the direction slightly, but within 15 seconds, they're back on course and they're crossing the runways again. So they're really, with great blue herons now, they're really one that you have to get the timing down right to make sure that you're getting that animal across the runway as fast as it can and not getting in the way of traffic.
How big a job is this at SeaTac? Do you have a crew that's dedicated to this effort?
Yeah, we have different levels of effort out there. We have 8 airport duty managers, and they are also the ones that are enforcing and keeping track of the other 139 issues. And they are trained annually with the use of shotguns and pyrotechnic devices and also bird identification. So they're doing at least 2 surveys a day, 2 3-minute surveys a day. That gives us kind of an index of a possible changes in bird populations over the years. And then in addition to that, we have 12 other airport duty managers that are also trained in the same way. And between this group of port employees, these 20 people, we always have several people out on the ramp and out on the moving areas, looking around, doing wildlife control in addition to their other responsibilities. So in addition to that, we also have 2 people from USDA Wildlife Services that are here. They're doing a lot of our live trapping of the starlings. They're still live trapping our pigeons, some of the pigeon issues. And they're also doing surveys of some of the new wetland areas that were enhanced. I'm not going to say created, but they were enhanced because of the third runway and the wetland mitigation requirements that were associated with that. So,
right.
The idea there is just to make sure that we're really not creating more wildlife habitat, hazardous wildlife habitat. And so we do long-term monitoring to see if any changes need to be made.
I guess the final question should be from the perspective of a general aviation pilot, maybe of a smaller aircraft. Obviously, there are some very consequential bird strikes that happen in that world. If someone is flying small aircraft in an area where birds are likely to be present, is there anything we can do to decrease the odds of a bird strike as pilots?
Well, it's interesting you ask, because several pilots who have hit birds have found out that birds have a tendency to go down when they're threatened. So if a pilot were to pull up, you may be in a better situation to avoid most of those hits, because the birds would have a greater tendency to dive.
Interesting. Is there a time of day issue? I mean, you mentioned crows returning to the roost in the evening.
Yeah, generally about midday. Well, daylight period is certainly, you get more strikes than you do at night, because there's more diurnal birds out there than there are nocturnal birds. But when you look at raptors and some of the raptor trapping and relocation that we do, some of our best success in trapping raptors is in the early morning hours. So from that, and I haven't looked at the times, but it would be interesting. Maybe some of the Raptor strikes do occur more frequently in the morning.
Well, Steve, we're about out of time here. We never even got to the topic of your radar testing at SeaTac. Could we get back with you tomorrow to talk about the Avian Radar Project?
Yeah.
Good, thank you. Steve Osmick is the full-time wildlife biologist on staff at the Port of Seattle. More with Steve tomorrow. The port's website, by the way, can be found at www.portseattle.org. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.